Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by two regulars. John Flowers, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
And David Strapinis, how are you, sir?
I'm quite well as well.
I am less well, being completely stressed out and not miserable, but generally under the gun. But I apologize about that. I will try and tune out of my scheduling concerns and tune in to this week's film, which is The Knowing, Alex Proyas's latest film. So let's start with what we think of the film generally, guys. John, any sort of overall view of the film?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, whenever you smash together the creator of Donnie Darko and the creator of Dark City and The Crow, you're going to get a film like Knowing. I should point out, probably, if for those who don't know me, I loved both Dark City and Donnie Darko. And I thought that this show had a lot of a smattering of David and I were talking a little bit earlier, a smattering of kind of revelations with the director's cut of Donnie Darko thrown in or peppered throughout it. So
what about you, David?
I really enjoyed this, which surprised me because it has Nicolas Cage in it. But I think the new marker will be any movie that Nicolas Cage heavily drinks in is a good one. I'm also a fan of Alex Proyas' work, and before the fanboys attack, he didn't create The Crow. That was James O'Barr. He merely did the movie. I thought it was quite a good movie. There's one small thing that occurred to me during the movie which kind of ruined it for me, but I'm going to be more positive and to say I really liked it. It's a very slow, deliberate film, but I like that aspect of it.
Yeah, I liked it. And I was kind of surprised because when I was looking at reviews around the place, the more populist press, both in my country and yours, like the USA Today's and in my case, the Sun Herald, just canned it as being not a very good film at all. And I was really surprised about that.
It was ripped to shreds. I mean, on Rotten Tomatoes right now, it's like a 21 out of 100.
And I wonder why that is. What do you put that down to?
Well, I think it's because first of all, I like the fact that since 9/11, we haven't had that many disaster movies, I think for obvious reasons, and other than The Day After Tomorrow, and this is like an old-fashioned disaster movie on one level, but unlike your Armageddon, your Deep Impact, your whatever it may be, the disaster happens, and everyone dies. By the way, spoiler alert.
Not everyone dies.
Not everyone dies, and that's kind of
pretty
the whole point
much
of it. But
almost everybody dies.
But pretty much everyone dies, and I think people are expecting, they're watching a movie and you go, okay, they're going to get out of this somehow, and then, they actually do a really brilliant thing story-wise, which is when they kill the mother, the mother of the little girl, it's like, oh, okay, well, she did die on that day. Everyone else is going to live. It's okay. And, oh, crap, everyone's on fire. I thought it was really cool the way they did that. And I think people as a whole don't like downer endings.
I guess it was a downer ending. It was, it did have, some sort of rays of hope. I guess for me, just as a film, I found myself interested in it because it wasn't super predictable as to what was going to happen next, and I was kind of dead curious to follow along what happened. I'm not, again, a big Nick Cage fan, but, I found his performance to be good. I am an Alex Proyas fan, and I liked the film a lot, and it has many aspects to it, I think, that are worth discussing today. One of them is the plot, but the other two that I'd like to spend most of our time discussing is firstly the visual effects, as we would do, and secondly the fact that it was shot on the red camera. It's the first big sort of Hollywood feature to be shot fully on the red camera. Let's start with finishing out our section on the plot. So I just have to get back to this point you alluded to, David, as to something that ruined it for you three quarters of the way through when you suddenly had a moment of clarity. What was that?
Yeah, it was I was sitting there thinking about the numbers that were written down on the sheet, and as he's doing his research and he's showing like 43 dead, 85 dead, 155 dead, and 2,300 dead, and the number system, if they had just put a dash between them, there's no way of telling here's where the date is, here's where the number of dead people are. And then there's like the whole thing about you know, there's the latitude and longitude, but if there's no way of delineating between the two, so you have no way of figuring out, is four people going to die, or is 485,668 people going to die? And that was just like the one place where it fell apart logically for me. And then, of course, the other thing I really, really, really loved is the fact that there was a lisping astrophysicist who is a hero in the movie, which I really liked. That one little plot point of not being able to delineate each little piece of the numbers, and I understand why they didn't do that, you know, because the visual impact of a page full of numbers is much stronger, but not doing that, kind of like once you realize that, you're like, oh, there's no real way of breaking the code. So,
well, I have many links into this film. One of them is I actually worked on the film as a post-production supervisor on the film with Ben Mendelsohn, the guy you're referring to, here in Australia. In fact, I won an AFI award for it. So, and I have a lot of links to this film and otherwise. I know lots of people that worked on it. So lots of disclaimers. But yeah, okay, well, let's swing our attention, because I think, you know, some of those plot points are completely valid, but to the certain extent, that is the film. Let's swing our attention to the visual effects work. And the visual effects were primarily done by Animal Logic. So, John, you want to lead us off in the discussion, what you actually thought of the VFX for a second?
I should start by saying, absolutely, Animal Logic did a bunch of it. Some people at Weta did some. Boof did some. I mean, they're just... The number of visual effects houses involved in this was surprisingly small, but the guys who were involved did a ton of shots. You mentioned Animal Logic. My understanding is that Animal Logic did 400 shots in this film. At the end of the day, only about 230 some odd of them were used, 247 apparently, 250. So, and Animal Logic was responsible for just a tremendous amount of the really big visual effects sequences. I also know that Haiku Post did some work, and do you know the guys in Postmodern Sydney? They did some work as well.
Yeah, no, Postmodern. Postmodern did cool. Kind of the car stuff, like, you know, through the window kind of stuff. Postmodern's a pretty small house. Them not great guys, but they're just not. Animal is like, right, you know, much
and
larger.
Haiku did a bunch of like green screen composites and just a bunch of touch up, like a bunch of
Animal Logic definitely did the heavy lifting. Like
There is some seriously off the scale heavy lifting in this thing.
I will say that Boof did some of that, you know, the end and the explosion sequences of the city. Like Animal took, I think, they took the Empire State, and Boof took Chrysler Building. Like it was, but that's where Boof was contributing. So Boof did some good shots, not as much heavy lifting as Animal, but yeah.
So I would say in this movie there are four just enormous visual effects scenes. There's the plane, the 747 crashing. There's the subway crash, right? There's the whatever the hell is going on at the end with the Dayglow aliens. And then there's the, you know, basically when the sun flare hits the earth. And those, all four of those shots are, as near as I can tell, like, at, you know, around 2 to 3 minutes long each. I mean, they're just they're just epic shots. It's unbelievable. The plane crash especially.
Well, I think the plane crash was one of the most spectacular. I mean, well, no, I shouldn't say that. It was one of the most unexpected at the point that it happened in the film. If you didn't know it was coming, it was just...
Well, the film was crawling along at its own pace, right? And just trying, you know, very hard to make a point about every single nuance of everything that was going on in just that Dark City Donnie Darko tradition. And then WTF, right? This 747 comes along and you're not expecting it, like you said, and it's out of control. I mean, there's a little over 3.5 minute handheld shot that they had to track for that,
including burning bodies. And as someone said in my Twitter feed, when did burning bodies coming out of a plane wreck have that kind of rating on the film? Because I thought it was quite graphic actually at that point.
I was surprised absolutely by the graphicness of violence that was in this movie, because you know, also the train wreck sequence was also incredibly violent, and
The train wreck sequence was one of the most brutal things I've ever seen on film. I mean, it was just
the people on fire, the vision with the animals on fire. You know, it was a lot of setting up. Hey, the whole world's gonna burn. which I think was really well done. Like, if you look back at some of the scenes in this movie, they really do a good job of setting up everything in the story is there for a reason. You know, when he's that scene in his classroom where he's talking to his students, and he talks about how, you know, the Earth is at the exact right distance, that if it was any farther away, it would be too right. cold, and if it was any closer, it would be too hot. You know, just talking about how little tiny differences in the temperature of the planet can really affect whether or not people live here, which of course has a whole environmental message going along, but that wasn't in your face like some other disaster movies have been. But the work too. The work by Animal Logic is just fantastic, and you know, no dancing penguins here.
Well, actually, I mean, okay, so I like that dancing penguins, but I mean, let's give credit. Eric Durst, who was not with Animal, came out as visual effects supervisor, and he shared the visual effects supervisor title with Andrew Jackson. And as I said, Andrew's a good friend of mine. I used to work with him, and I have a lot of time for both those guys. Eric, we did an episode of FX Guide TV, an interview with him a little while ago discussing stuff, and Andrew's coming up on FX Guide discussing this film. But Andrew's actually got a practical background. He's like incredibly hands-on. Like, if you needed to, he would just build something with a, like, you know, acetylene torch kind of practical guy. And of course, also a master of digital stuff. And Animal's track record, I think, is now pretty much established. They both do that visual effects work, like this film, and the fully animated features, like Happy Feet. And I think that that really, just looking at it from a visual effects point of view, that plane crash could have looked pretty hokey and actually had such a visceral kind of, you know, effect. I wasn't aware of sort of bad flames or bad comped flames or, you know, bad tracking anything. And the tracking of that, and when they come out of the subway, which was some of the worst tracking tasks they had to do, I think, you know, Animal did a superb job technically. I just think it was really good.
Well, thinking about the movie afterwards, the plane crash reminded me of two things. One, the plane crash in Fight Club, where the plane, you know, crashes into it on top of it, which also made me think that no one will be watching this particular movie on any flights. and then the other thing, of course, is the debris on the ground. It reminded me a lot of both Lost and of War of the Worlds, where they had the plane crash on top of the house there.
There was a huge nod to Lost when he walks by the turbine engine, and you think...
Absolutely.
Yeah, they had that had to be a wink to Lost.
I think that shot, you know, that long tracking shot, you know, through all this debris and everything like that, with all the visual effects that were added in, and the fact it was done on a red camera, I think can say to every tracker and visual effects person around the world who's complaining about having to work on red with its rolling shutter, can suck it. Because this was really beautifully done, perfectly matched, and I didn't notice any kind of tracking errors anywhere in it. So Ever can, you know, pour themselves a big glass of shut the hell up.
I think the thing about the train sequence I liked is that, and this is coming from Andrew, who spoke to me after I saw a screening. He said that Alex Proyce was very keen to try and do everything as much as possible in shot. So instead of having, say, tons of elements all shot separately and then all comped together, they had, you know, sort of a big practical set with things sort of blasting apart and trains and stuff and people running. And a lot of those people were stunt people that were doing stuff in shot. And Alex's approach was to try and keep it as visceral and as real as possible, which I think also reflects well, or resonates probably with Andrew's practical effects background. So even though there was a lot of digital, because you don't crash trains through, you know, people like that, there was a tremendous base of live action stuff. And I think, you know, shout out to the physical effects guys, because that sequence, I thought, as I think you just said a second ago, John, was one of the most impactful things I'd seen on screen for ages. Was that you that said that, John, a second ago?
Oh yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, the sheer number of people. And my understanding is that was a shot that was pre-visualized, you know, five dozen times before they had it down to exactly what they wanted. And then you have all of these people running around and stuntmen and stuntwomen on wires. And I mean, just the amount of work to
get everything
to move out of the way and throw the debris around was pretty breathtaking.
The only problem I had with that sequence had nothing to do with the visual effects, and that there was a very sudden and very drastic change in the color timing, the DI that went on from above ground to below ground. That was kind of jarring, but there's one shot in that where it was like a camera was right at the head window as the train car is sliding along the floor of the station, and you see bodies hitting it and becoming blood splatters really quickly and just kind of disintegrating against it. And I was like, that is a powerful shot. It was just the kind of disregard that the movie had for human life was, I think, quite strong, because it was just like, you know, there's people dying a lot and all the time. And the only ones that, you know, the main character, you know, he was affected by it, but the whole his being affected by it was what he saw. You know, he wasn't concerned with the fact that these people died in the plane wreck. He was concerned with, oh my God, I just saw people on fire. And it's horrible, but it's about what's affecting him. And I thought that was a very realistic, non-melodramatic way of handling it. You know, the people that are dying that matter to them are the people that are close to him, not, you know, the fact that people die is horrible. But I'm talking about in the world, but people die every day, but the ones that we really care about are the ones who are close to us. And the way they handled that, I thought was, brutal and, truthful. And I really like that.
Actually, I'm going to jump in on that point you made earlier. I agree with that point, but I wanted to come back to your point about color timing, because, we haven't got to the end sequence yet, but I really want to comment on color timing, because the only thing I didn't like about this, and the thing that I thought was the only weak point, well, actually, probably there was two that I didn't like, but one was only a weak point. I didn't particularly like the music. I thought it was pretty pretty heavy-handed, and it sort of took me out of the film almost. But no, the only thing that I thought, that's probably just a personal choice, but the only thing that I didn't like technically was the color timing, and in particular, I didn't like the school when the time capsule was pulled out. Now, there was a lot of color timing in this, and not least of which is because if you've ever been to Australia, you know we don't have those autumn colors. So those leaves on the trees, all those autumn colors, that's all, you know, basically put in visually. Nevertheless, I just didn't like the color timing on the sequence when the... did anyone else notice that? It was kind of flat and lacking almost dynamic range when they were pulling out the time capsule in the modern era?
I did.
Yeah. I noticed there were about four scenes where I noticed that the color was just not.
Now that was Park Road Post, and Park Road Post traditionally does terrific work, and actually normally does insanely good red work. They really worked up their red workflow, so I'm kind of a bit surprised about that. And I thought it might have been a technical issue with the camera, but I'm told by various other people that I've spoken to that the R3Ds were fine. It was just literally the color timing decisions that were made on those scenes that made it look that way.
Yeah, there's one other scene which bothered me that I noticed in viewing, like that actually, you know, very rarely do I try to pull apart a movie as I'm watching it. I try to enjoy it as a whole and then think about it afterwards. But when something pulls me out, I really notice it. And the scene where the creepy blonde-haired guy eventually revealed to be an alien, where he's in the kid's room and then points out the window right before the vision happens. Mm-hmm. I thought the blacks were really soft. Like, they were not real black.
I saw that a lot too, David. There were actually several scenes where I thought, I mean, when we got underground in the subway, the blacks were just inky and rich and beautiful. And then when we were in several other places, like above ground or inside a house, it was just, the blacks were not, maybe it was just the, you know, the version I saw, or there was some, but the blacks were awful in several scenes.
Yeah, they were weak in a lot of areas, or not a lot of areas, but they were weak more than a few times. But that was like the one scene, because that scene is almost all black. You know, there's just a little bit of edge lighting on the characters. but I really noticed on that one.
I'm, Okay, so like I agree with you with my critic hat on. I completely agree with you. If I had my working for a living hat on, I'd be like, oh God, if you guys only knew how hard it was to turn the leaves into the right colors and all the work we did, and this is what you pick up. You know what I mean? Like, in some respects, as a working practitioner myself, I like feel really sorry to whoever's listening to this from Park Road Post, because they've probably done an enormous amount of work and we're just like picking at the edges. But unfortunately, I do have to agree with you. I just thought that the color timing was the only thing that didn't, you know, well, really gel with me.
Well, here's the thing. We're not complaining about the leaves looking wrong. I grew up in the area where this movie is supposed to take place, and I bought it completely as being from Southern New England. It looked like Southern New England to me. So that goal was achieved. You know, there's no problem with that. But
come on, like, you're working on a film right now, right? Like, I'm working on a TV series. And don't you just at some level feel like karma's going to come back and bite us? Like, it seems like when we're doing the show, like, we kind of get really nitpicky on stuff. And I know that that's our job. But also, by the same token, I just feel like I've offended the critic gods, and it's going to come back and kill me.
Well, two things on that. One, I've made a career out of offending people.
Okay.
And two, I'm working on the production, not in the post-production. So I'll just blame it all on post.
But you know, it's like you go, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter how many shots you have or how long you had or how much money you had to do it. People are like, oh, picky, picky, picky. And but anyway, I digress. I know that's the job, and I just apologize.
I was going to say, I thought that was sort of the point of the show, is to talk about what worked and what doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, it's a...
It's criticism without being... Well, you've got to acknowledge, though, like that a lot of the community listens to this, right? I mean, we know.
Yeah, well, we're not trying to be snarky pricks in order to be snarky pricks.
Yeah, okay.
But if we came on and said, yeah, the effects are awesome, yeah, the effects are awesome, yeah, the effects are awesome, done. That would have a very little shelf life as a podcast.
Well, put it this way, because we're snarky sometimes, when we say that we think that the visual effects were magnificent in this, they do carry some gravitas. So I don't know what you're saying. I'm just feeling sensitive and exposed.
Speaking of snarky, I have a question. Did someone who worked on this film work on Fantastic Four? Because there is a scene where one of the trains is sliding along, and I swear to all things sacred, the color is the same color palette and the same lookup tables and everything that was used in Fantastic Four. And the freaking train has a four on the front of it that looks like the Fantastic Four. You know, I wonder if that was like a little
wink.
That'd
be a Weta thing, right? Did they do Fantastic Four?
That
stuff?
Is funny to me, yeah.
I didn't know.
So
yes,
if you're out
I'm
there,
sorry.
I caught it.
Okay.
And I thought it was funny, but it was weird.
I think
too.
The four is there and looks like the four from Fantastic Four. Because if you had seen the documentary Helvetica, you'll know that all of New York subway systems are all Helvetica.
Helvetica, great documentary.
Great documentary. Yeah.
But that doesn't explain the colors, though.
Okay, that doesn't explain the colors. All right, so hang on.
No.
Let's talk about the ending for a second, right? Because we've talked about two other things I want to get to. I want to get this ending, and then I want to get to the red. The ending had incredibly strong biblical religious overtones, which were not accidental.
Yeah.
No. It was it actually reminded me of Indiana Jones 4, but in a different way.
I was thinking
because
the same thing, except done well.
at the end of Indiana Jones, you're like, oh fuck, it's aliens.
But at the end of this, you weren't like, oh, it's aliens. You were like, oh, all right, it's aliens. That makes
total you're like,
sense.
It's great, it's aliens. But the other things I thought it had a lot in common with were both. I'm going to really bust out the nerd chops here. Both Battlestar Galactica, the finale, and the old TV series Babylon 5. Because as the aliens are kind of flying upwards into the little sphere enclosure thingy with the kids, you know, they have this kind of energy falling off their back that made it look like angel wings. And they were obviously supposed to be angels. And in Babylon 5,
ambiguous. They were supposed to be, maybe it's angels. They weren't meant to be like deliberately angels. They were meant to be like, we're not definitely saying they're angels. We're just saying, if you pick up on that and you're not quite 100% sure, we did our job.
Oh, come on. They were angels.
Yeah, I was gonna say if they were trying to be ambiguous, they should have toned it. They should have turned the dial from 11 to 2.
I think they got a good. I think they got a good level. It wasn't like, you know, fluffy white wings with feathers, but it was angelic. True. It was angelic.
Yes.
I guess I'm reminded. This is like an art direction point. I'm reminded of Wall-E. Like if you're gonna go, I'm gonna go with Wall-E as my reference because it just struck me there's a very inefficient way to fly around the galaxy. It seemed a lot of stuff just for a couple of people. It was like when Eve got dropped on the planet and there was like, you know, this enormous spaceship to get her there. Like any of these spaceships seems like they're very inefficient in terms of space. Seemed like a very complicated mechanism to get up inside a spaceship. No?
Well, it's a little
in the future though.
What in the future they just decide to be really inefficient in getting up in spaceships?
No, I was going to say in the future they don't think of time, space, or energy in the same way that we do. So the very size and nature and construction and perceived amount of energy that we see on a spaceship from people who are highly advanced doesn't take up the same amount that it would if we built it. You got to think about this differently, Mike.
My theory is that particular spaceship was made by an American car company.
Well, yeah, like Chrysler or whoever. Speaking of car companies, you know the one major, like, I can't fucking believe this bitch that I have about this movie. Every single computer in the classroom when he was first talking, everyone without exception was a freaking Dell laptop. Every single person had a Dell on their
desk. Maybe it was a Dell laptop lab.
You know what? Though
everyone was a different Dell. It wasn't uniform. So you would think, if this came from the school, maybe. But they were all different.
This is the thing that bugs you?
God, it drove me crazy. Yes.
No, that actually makes sense.
There's not a single classroom I've ever been in where every single person had a Dell computer. I mean, it was so strikingly outside of what I'm used to. It shocked me the whole time.
The big difference is, and I say this as someone who has also taught at some schools. Like, I'm not saying that this is how it is. I'm just saying this is a way you can valid plot point. A lot of schools, they'll have a deal with a particular company that students get an extra discount off, and they'll have a store right on campus, and that would make somewhat of a sense.
Okay, well, notwithstanding product placement, when it's not like it's the first time we've ever seen product placement.
No, but it was just so off the charts to me.
It didn't really annoy me.
Okay.
I did think that I thought where you were going when somebody said cars was the car hit where the mother died, which I thought was pretty strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again,
really well done.
Brutal disregard for human life. That's what, you know, by not setting it up and not really playing it up and just being like, she's alive and bam, it hits you a lot harder, you know. And for a movie about precognition, that's good.
And speaking of car crashes, I saw a preview for The Taking of Pelham 123, the remake of the 1974 film, the Joseph Sargent film. I don't know if you've seen it, but the new film has Travolta in it, but there was they on screen showed like three car crashes in the preview for that film. So,
okay,
seems car crashes are back in.
They are, okay. So now I get to rub my hands together with glee and say, can we discuss the camera for a second? Because I just can't, me personally can't get past the fact that I was all moist and happy that I'm watching the film that was shot on the red camera. So
wait, you've heard of the red camera?
I think I have. So let me hear what your thoughts were on how wonderful the pictures looked and how magnificent it was and how interesting it was to see it shot on the red camera.
Well, I would like to say for the record that whoever is near anyone who was involved even remotely in shooting this should take them out to dinner, your treat, every single time that they ask you to, because my understanding is this was shot on build 15.
Yep.
And if that is in fact true,
yep,
everybody, every single person who touched the red and was involved in the workflow at all deserves a freaking medal. It's amazing that it looked as good as it did and they were shot and it was all shot on build 15. I mean, that to me, that's like Atlas carrying the world around, or, you know,
well, it's still shot build 16 and they hadn't perfected a number of other things as well. That was a log 685 workflow, I'm pretty sure.
So yeah.
If you wanted to be critical about it, you should never see a film shot on Red that would be worse than this technically. This should be as bad as it ever gets, because everything from this point on should be, as you say, on build 16, which is the kind of the release build, the release where they got their act together, and it should be solved for a whole lot of color space and workspace issues. So if anyone saw this,
you're setting
this
the bar really high, Mike, if you're saying that this is the low bar for
this is what I'm saying.
Setting the bar really high, because this, I mean, there were, except for a few scenes with the blacks, which could have just been color correction, you know, or color timing or some kind of issue with the print that I had. Except for that, I would have sworn, if no one told me this was shot on the Red, except for those few things, I would have sworn to all things sacred that this was shot on film. I mean, it looks like film.
I don't think that this film looked remarkably better than something shot really well by a good cinematographer on film, or shot really good by the really good cinematographer on, you know, Genesis on a good day kind of thing, except for the fact that I actually think that it, I don't even think that it's just a money thing, right? I think it's just if you want to sort of tick the box that you can shoot Red and make it look filmic, then that box is ticked. I'm not saying that you should throw out all 35mm cameras. I'm not saying you should throw out all other cameras. I'm not saying that it's a warfare of attrition that only leaves Red standing. I'm just simply saying that those that were critical of Red and critical of its ability to be used for a serious sort of workflow and color grading and all the other things that you want, I mean, you just got to say that the boxes are ticked. I mean, that's my personal experience. Like, I'm on a big, big Red project now England, and we've got tons of green screen, and it's keying really well, and we're grading it really well. We had no tracking problems. But, I mean, that's, you know, you can say all these things until you're blue in the face when people haven't seen it. But when it starts going to air and starts appearing in films and it just does look good, then I think you tick the box and put the discussion to bed. And as I say, it should only get better from here on Red Ones, and better again when we move to Epics and sort of the next generation after that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was good. I didn't think it looked digital or video-y at any part except for one shot. Bugged me. When he's walking through the woods and he hears a noise, swings around and sees the deer, that shot of the deer I thought looked very, very tapey.
I think that whole shot was manufactured, though. I mean, I don't think that was an in-camera shot. I think that was, it felt like a freaking slap comp pre-viz that they had to rush out. I mean, it did not feel like it was shot on the camera.
It was rough. It was rough, and I'm not sure exactly
really
why.
It was rough, yeah.
But the
made of rubber, for one, so that was bad.
I should also point out that not all this stuff was shot on 4K. I mean, it was shot on the Red, but some of it was shot at less than 4K on the Red.
Yeah, the other thing that bugged me, there's a handheld shot in the classroom where he's explaining, you know, determinism versus randomness, and I don't know what it was, but you know, they're going for that green grass handheld feel, a la the Bourne look, or whatever you want to call it. And there's something about it that just felt edgy and sharp compared to how handheld normally feels that I didn't like particularly. I think, you know, I would have preferred this to keep it off of handheld and maybe keep it on a Steadicam. But other than that, you know, I don't think it was a particularly adventuresome movie in terms of its cinematography choices. You know, it's not as good as, say, Benjamin Button or Dark City. But I think it was very capably shot, and I don't think it looked like video. It looked like film. It was really well done.
Well, I was trying to think about, I think it looks better than anything that I have ever seen shot on a Genesis. I mean, I think that it looks...
Oh, I would disagree there.
More... Well, that's okay. You know, we're each entitled to our opinion, right, wrong, good, bad, ugly, or indifferent. I definitely think, though, that it looked more like what I've come to expect from film, you know, from really high quality film than anything that I've seen shot on a Genesis before. And that's not to say anything bad about the Genesis. It's just to say that whoever worked on this film really knew what they were doing with the Red. And that shows. I think it really shows.
I can tell you they didn't going in, because I was at Animal when we did the pitch to Alex to use it. I mean, it was our Red that he put on his shoulder for the first time, though he actually never actually shot handheld on the actual thing. But we had whiteboard sessions where we were drawing up, trying to explain how the Red workflow worked when we were involved in the early days, just giving some advice. But I think that my point about that is not my involvement, which was almost none, but that, in fact, if you get really good cinematographers like Simon Duggan and you get really good editors like Richard Leroy and you get really good people that know what they're doing, then they solve the problems and they do stuff and it looks good, because so much of the problem with good cinematography has got little to do with the sensor and a lot to do with how you light a scene and the quality of the light and the way that it works. And, you know, that's kind of universal. And as long as you can mount really good glass on a, because I mean, it must make a huge technical difference how good the lenses are. As long as you, you know, can use good quality lenses, and obviously they did and can on a Red, then I think that, you know, you don't need to know a lot about the Red to get great results out of the Red. I mean, I think you need, and I've always said this, a good DOP and good lenses. And then as long as it's a good lighting DOP, the rest you can solve. And anyone like Animal or, you know, any of those big companies are going to have the technical stuff in-house to solve the problems properly. And, you know, Park Road Post, these companies know what they're doing. Heck, Park Road Post were the guys, you know, on the original Peter Jackson Crossing film. So it's not like they didn't have some experience. I just think, like, it's not an exclusive thing that you need to know how to use it so much as it is you just need, you know, good professional film people approaching the problem with good quality gear, and it'll just happen.
No, of course not. I mean, you know, if you have a film camera, you know, the only reason the DP will know how the film camera itself works is because he came up, you know, he was a camera loader, then he was a, you know, first camera assistant, and, you know, he worked his way up and he became a DP. That's how he knows how the inside of a camera works. But it's not important you have a film camera for the DP to know how the camera works. You know, he needs to know what film stock he's using and what lens he's using and the lights he's using. That's all he needs to know. Everything else, you know, he doesn't care how the film is developed. It's not his concern. That's someone else's job. And it's the same thing with digital. The DP's job will be to light the scene, to make sure that the camera is good, you know, set for quote unquote the right stock, you know, meaning that the settings you can't change afterwards are set, and that's it. But as we move forward, you'll have DPs who have experience with the Genesis and experience with the Red and will know every little way the camera works. And then when they become DPs, they'll know all that. But it's not important to, you know, the director of photography is a creative position, not a technical position. So it's the technical is taken care of by everyone else. So I agree. It I don't go into a movie going, man, I'm going to love this movie because of what camera they used. And I'm not going to leave a movie going, I hated this movie because of what camera they used. But as long as it looks good, you know, you look at a movie like 21, which doesn't look good, and shot digital, or you look at a movie that's shot beautifully and is digital, and you don't care. It's just, you know, is the movie pretty or not? That end of story. That's the only question you should ask. The technology is irrelevant. Now, for us and for you in particular,
I think that's actually close, but not. I'm not going to give you 100% on that one from my point of view, because while I totally agree that Simon Duggan and stuff, but take someone like Ross Emery, who was second unit DOP, right? Like, there is a level of technical stuff on complex green screen, getting the best out of the camera. That requires someone like Ross to be, you know, and Ross shot second unit on, I don't know, Superman Returns, right, on the Genesis. Like, he's very technically competent, as well as being a good lighting guy. On effects, second unit stuff, that, I don't know, it's quite as clear as you're making it out to be. Like, I don't think it's just a camera operator problem.
Well, it's not just a camera operator problem, but what I'm saying is that the technical problems, you know, can be sorted out, can be taught.
I'm in agreement with you there. Yeah, I'm in total agreement. Yeah,
right. No matter what the camera or the technology is, the technology problems can be solved either by, you know, picking up the manual, asking someone who knows, but it's knowledge that's concrete and can be taught. Whereas the talent of a DP is more ethereal. It's an artistic thing. So the technology matters less than, and the hardware matters less than the person making the decisions, right? You can give someone without a clue a fully stocked Red with every lens in the world that they have access to, you know, a 2.5-ton grip truck, and their stuff will look awful. You can give somebody who knows what they're doing a, you know, 16mm camera and a couple of work lights and some foam core for bounces, and it will look beautiful. Because it's about how you use what you're given. So I'm saying that the DP's job is less technical than it is creative.
No, I totally agree with you, and that's a point I was trying to make, right? Is that, like, if you get a really good team that knows the art or the craft, I should say, of the and the, you know, the creative, then the technical can be solved. I guess I'm just saying that some of the stuff that you do on these effects films does push technical stuff as well as that, and you know, it's like getting the best out of a camera is
absolutely, and that's an opportunity for people who do know that. You know, if you know the technical and you know the creative, you know, when the opportunity arises to step up, you know, you're there. You know, and that's how you can get ahead. By saying, oh yeah, I know how to do this setting and get the best green screen possible. And they're like, okay, well, you're a second unit guy. You know, even if you were just a camera loader 5 seconds ago. Usually doesn't happen like that, but, you know, and that's why you should definitely have all the technical knowledge you know. But, you know, Hollywood is filled with people who got ahead creatively or are able to make the big creative choices because they had the technical knowledge. But you can always hire somebody who has the technical knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's, I'm good. I think I'm in agreement with you there. What about you, John?
Well, I had an opportunity to use the exact same setup with the same lights, the same green screen, and the same actress. And I shot, you know, and it was people who knew what they were doing setting it up. And I shot basically the same scene 4 times. I shot it on a Red, I shot it on a Viper, I shot it on a Sony EX1 and a JVC GY-HD 250. And I can tell you, I know which footage I would rather key. So I would just like to leave it at that.
Okay. Well, I'm not.
I'm not saying that there's no difference between the technology. What I'm saying is,
I'm just saying that's where it matters, and there's a point in which once you have the image, it matters, and the kind of footage that you have from certain cameras makes post a hell of a lot easier if the camera gives you the kind of latitude that you need to actually do decent post work.
Right. I mean, that's the same thing as if you're in a film camera and you have, you know, you have film stock, you know, you have to be able to make the right film stock choices. Your choices are made before you ever show up on set. But what I'm saying is that it's not the DP's job to be worrying about the technical details on set. You know,
no, I mean, you should sort all of that out beforehand. And once they're on set, all that stuff should be a given, right? Like, they should have tested it, rated it, be comfortable with what it's producing, and yeah. And look, you know, I mean, for me, it's game over on the footage question on the Red. It's delivered. It looks great. As far as this film goes, changing the subject back to the film, I think it's for me, hands down, great work from Animal Logic and Boof and the others that worked on it.
The one sequence we didn't really talk about, we glanced on it, that I do want to acknowledge, was, because I thought it was really, really, really nice work, the aliens themselves. With all their internal structures and everything that was going on in them, I thought was really well done. really well built and rigged.
Yeah, I had a moment where I thought, boy, I really wish that the same people who worked on these aliens had spent some time on Dr. Manhattan. Because I thought that while Dr. Manhattan looked phenomenally good, there were aspects of these aliens, there was so much detail where you never felt that kind of Stretch Armstrong-y kind of plastic or rubberized feeling with these aliens.
Yeah, and they moved with a realistic amount of, like sometimes, you're right, they all feel like they're moving through molasses a bit, that there's not the right degree of snap or movement. It's all like a bit ethereal, wafty, bendy, rubbery thing. And I think it was good. I think that they looked good. I think it all looked good. I think that the fact that this has got bad reviews is that this just isn't a populist film with a happy ending, with a, you know, bubblegum, popcorn-y kind of approach to, you know, an action sci-fi or horror right. flick. And maybe it's a genre problem. Maybe people are going expecting one genre and getting another. But if liking Dark City, you're going to like this film.
Well, and I was just going to say, I mean, if you look at Donnie Darko and you look at Dark City and you look at a film I've mentioned once or twice, Fight Club, all of those films, well, they all share a lot in common with this film in many ways. But all of those films, I would say, were box office failures. I mean, they picked up their audience on DVD for sure. Or, you know, they picked up their audience after they were available for rent. And I think this is going to be one of those films. I mean, because I remember the critics, they will deny it now because, you know, that's how they roll. But the critics panned Fight Club. I mean, just, I remember reading the reviews because I'd read the novel. And the reviews were awful. I mean, they were horrible for Fight Club. I mean, just across the board, just like with Knowing, across the board, it's like a flocking pattern. The reviews are like, you know, terrible, awful, and you know, everyone mentions Nicolas Cage, but Mike, I think you said on Red Center at some point, man, Nicolas Cage did a very good job in this film. He was absolutely believable, and I forgot that I was watching, you know, the same person who was in Next. I mean, it reminded me of an early Nicolas Cage. It reminded me of...
Yeah, I mean, the guy Nicolas was Oscar nominated for Fear and Loathing, right? I'm pretty sure.
Leaving Las Vegas.
Leaving Las Vegas. Yeah.
But, again, I think it all takes is a drinking Nick Cage, because he, you know, his character was drunk for most of the film, or had a bottle of scotch in hand, but the film I think is really well done. I don't know if it will find success. Because
it opened number one in the US with 24.8 million, so it's not exactly a flop at the box office.
Well, oh no, I'm not saying it's a flop. I'm saying that I have a feeling that word of mouth might not be kind to this movie because of the religious overtones and the fact that a lot of this country takes their religion very seriously, and they might not like the idea of their God being an alien. I don't think that might be handled too well, and the whole Garden of Eden from What Dreams May Come shot at the end there.
But it's not like, you know, the Vatican hasn't, like, I don't know, banned angels and demons or something. I mean, like, I think that you're right. I think it'll find an audience definitely in Blu-ray. And I think I'd love to see the rest of the deleted scenes, because if that's the 200 and something animal logic shots that got in, I want to see the other couple of hundred that didn't, because that destruction at the end was just, there was nowhere to hide on that destruction stuff. That was like, not, you know, burn out everything and you can't see what's going on, or limited kind of, you know, do it in close-ups like they had to do in Terminator. I mean, it was pretty intense, that destruction of Earth.
Yeah, I think the subway scene was the same way. I mean, the subway scene, to me, there was nowhere to hide. You know, the one thing I will say that we didn't touch on, and I hate to be nitpicky, but there, when it's handheld, the plane, the 747 crashes, and Nick Cage is running around, and there's flames everywhere. Again, it might have just been the print that I saw, but there was an absolute, to me, to my eye, crystal clear difference between the flames that were real and the flames that were not real. The color was
I mean, you must have had a bad print because I saw it, like, saw a pristine print.
Well, that's why I'm caveating it, because maybe it just, you know, the print that that we got here at, you know, the
I looked around thinking, I wonder which ones of these are digital and which ones are real. And I was
I could have pointed them out. I could have, you know, I could have froze the frame and pointed exactly to them. And so it might have just been the print that we had, because it was absolutely obvious.
Cinema bloody distributors. Anyway, we need to wind up for this week. It's been a good discussion. I think we've given it the thumbs up. I think it's definitely a film that this audience, I think you guys would like. I think if you listen to this show, it's the kind of thing that you would really like. But, you know, don't go with your mum and a couple of people that are, like, you know, sort of not so much into that kind of genre, because it's not an easy film in some respects. But I do think
it's not a date movie. It's not a first date movie for sure.
Also, don't go if you're planning on getting on a plane, getting on a train, or driving an SUV anytime soon.
Yeah, pretty much if you're thinking of any form of mode of transport or living past tomorrow, don't go and see it. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, so John, do you want to give our credit roll?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd, you know, obviously like to thank the tireless producers who work on the show. We have Kristen Martin and... also, Lori Apthorpe does a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. She actually did some really great notes for us, a dossier, if you will, for us this time around. Lots of great information there. Thanks a lot, Lori. And this is a Pixel Core and FX Guide joint production.
And where can people sort of follow you and find out and listen to some of your other podcasts, John?
Well, I think probably a great place to start is lifezero.org. I wanted to take just 2 seconds and say that if you're interested in understanding how fast your systems are and how fast they can capture footage and read and write footage, I wrote a tool that I'm giving out for free called HD Speed Test. And if you go to lifezero.org, there's a link, or if you go to unscale.com, which is my company, there's a link to that tool. So it's just a real world benchmark for video speeds.
And I think when you tweeted that, there was a phenomenal response on the day that you first did it.
Yeah. No, there's been a really good response. I'm actually surprised at the number of people who've downloaded it and submitted feedback. And I think I had 165 emails over the weekend for suggestions or bug reports or just comments.
Well, speaking of Twitter, I want to thank the Twitter followers that were giving me their opinion on the film. My Twitter is / Mike Seymour. And David, where people can find you and what are you up to?
I am, of course, on the Twitter at davidstrapinos.com or Twitter at davidstrapinos, and I'm also www.davidstrapinos.com is my infrequently updated blog. Although that might be changing soon. And, of course, you can always get me at david@vfxshow.com. And that's working once again. There's problems on my end on that one. So if you sent me an email and I didn't get it, that's why. I'm going to actually be wrapping up my current production in the next couple of weeks. And then I'm going to be taking some time off, I believe. Unfortunately... the economy is not so great right now, as we are all, I'm sure, aware. I don't know if I'll have a job immediately following my current production, but I'll probably be hanging out and relaxing here in LA for at least a couple of weeks. So
before Vegas and the party.
Yes. I will still be employed at that point, but I will be...
You're not coming to Vegas?
No, I will still be employed at that point, but I will be coming to Vegas. I'll be at NAB on April 20th. I believe we are planning on doing a live podcast or a live show that will be podcasted later.
Are you going to be there, John?
I am. I'm going to be there. I'm actually, I think I might be speaking a little bit with Red Giant, and then I think there's a super booth or something where I'm doing a presentation on, drive speed or
excellent. We'll come
like
and heckle.
Yeah, please don't.
Guys, thanks so much for listening to us here on the VFX show. We really appreciate it. And until next time, talk to you guys later. See ya.